Anything worth saying is worth talking about. Deprogram with Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to the Michael Parker Show. This is your host, Owen Stevens. Joining me in the studio today is Dr. Richard Maximus Fleming. You guys can just call him Dr. Fleming. I'm going to call him Dr. Fleming. It's a pretty awesome name. A little too long for us, though. We're going over COVID-19 ever since the start of this pandemic. Ever since, you know, I think where you, just like 9/11, I think everybody remembers where they were when they realized COVID-19 was going to be a serious problem, or at least, you know, was phrased and you know, poised as a serious problem. You know, they basically lied to us about it being a serious and severe problem. But when it started, we had no idea. I had no idea. I'll tell you where I was. I was in college. I was in college in the middle of a history class talking about how America was racist. And my college professor paused the class and said, "Everybody, it looks as if you're all going to get to go home." And I was like, man, that's kind of awesome. That's the best. The virus started off pretty great for me, to be honest. I got to go home, didn't have to, you know, be in class for the day. It was awesome. We weren't learning anything good anyways. It was a bunch of leftist garbage anyways, so it was fine. But, you know, from the very beginning, there was this lie, a blizzard of lies about COVID-19. We didn't know where it came from. And the government, the hospitals, the entire health industry seemed to simultaneously agree on this one-size-fits-all narrative, this singular narrative that everybody had to bow down towards. And if you didn't bow down, if you didn't do exactly what they said, if you questioned anything that they had put forth, then you were an enemy of the state, to be dealt with violence, with financial, you know, with legal issues. It didn't stop, right? So this was a full-on attack, really, on the American people, on the freedom that we had enjoyed for so long. This is one of the avenues that they used to take our freedom away, and it's going to continue to be that. You know, what we've learned right now is that these viruses can be used to take freedom from your hands and then put power in the hands of a centralized, tyrannical organization or structure, a government, or, you know, like we're seeing with this World Economic Forum right now. That's what this virus was doing. That's what it did from the very beginning. We're talking to Dr. Fleming today. Dr. Fleming, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Very, very good. So you have been, from the, you know, the very beginning, you testified that SARS-CoV-2 was a lab-engineered bioweapon that funded by the U.S. government, the result of gain-of-function research on the spike protein, making it more infectious. You testified safe and effective treatments for the virus were suppressed by the U.S. health regulatory agencies. You testified that the quarantining of healthy people is completely ineffective. All of these things that you were right on point with from the very beginning, you know, and what recent developments, since you've been on point so well from the very beginning, what recent developments can you point everybody to regarding COVID-19 and some of the enlightening things that are coming out just now? Because we're still trying to figure all of this out. So many things are clouded and so many things are coming to light as we, you know, move forward in the next couple of months. So just explain to everybody what's going on with COVID-19.
Right. Well, I think what's obvious, hopefully to everybody paying attention, is that this has not gone away and it's not going to go away. There's going to be a series of variants that continue to pop up over the course of time. I think it's fascinating to listen to the President of the United States say that the pandemic is over, and then other people in the White House say, well, the pandemic isn't over. I think maybe they need to get a narrative and stay with a narrative that would possibly be helpful to them. You know, I have been trying to explain to people for a little bit more than 2.5 years now that the data is really, really clear, frighteningly so, if we just are wanting to look at it, that gain of function or the ability to make viruses, in this case, more infective or harmful, has been going on for more than 2 decades with these coronaviruses. We know that the federal government of the United States, through a variety of agencies, whether that's the Department of Defense, the National Institutes of Health, National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, and the people that are in those agencies know that they have been paying for research to alter these viruses, and they've been doing it in biological laboratories that are designed to house pathogens that are alter these viruses, and they've been doing it in biological laboratories that are designed to house pathogens that are harmful to people. So they know what they're doing. They've had a couple of decades to work on it. I've also tried to undo a lot of misinformation that's out there. And one of the pieces of misinformation, and I just ask your listeners to bear with me as I walk you through this, is the polymerase chain reaction test, or the PCR test. This is a test that Terry Mullis patented. I have a quantitative test, the only one of its kind, that can measure tissue changes inside the body. If you misapply my test, it does not make my test bad or wrong. It means you don't know what you're doing, or you've decided to misuse it. But I won't take that as a then Fleming method or FMT-VDM, whatever acronym you want to give to it, doesn't work. It means it works. It just means you don't know what you're doing. The same thing is true with PCR. And, you know, if you follow the patent that Mullis laid out to the T, it's a very good test. It does exactly what it's supposed to, which is to look for genetic sequences. And therein lies critical information for everybody, because when I've looked at Ralph Barrick's work from the University of North Carolina, and Xi Zhang Li from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and Peter Daszak, who got that funding at EcoHealth through the federal government to give to these folks, some fascinating things step up. First off, if we look at the PCR data, which looks for segments that are unique in this case, we can see that three very specific viruses that Ralph Barrick has published in the literature that he and got paid for by the federal government that he made stand out. They're all SARS coronaviruses. One is RS-3367. One is RS-SHC014. And one is MA15. And if you look at those viruses, every one of them match the PCR data that are that's being used for, quote, SARS coronavirus 2, SARS-CoV-2, which tells me that SARS-CoV-2 is not a single virus. It is at least these three viruses that were all being worked on in the Wuhan lab. The data from the lab, if you watch what happened in August, September, October, November of 2019, shows a very nervous group of people at the lab. They had people being admitted to hospital. They were worried about their computers being attacked. And so they shut down the information on the internet. But more importantly, they were asking for incinerator units and air filtration units, the types of things you would do if something leaked. Now, we know from, I know, and I've presented this to people, that there are at least five major lab leaks that have occurred over the last couple of decades, including SARS-CoV-1 from back in 2004, 2005, after it was initially dealt with in 2002 and 2003, and people got very sick. So we know that these lab leaks are not uncommon. We know that despite best intentions, humans make mistakes, either in engineering or in responding to emergencies. And we know that three of these viruses match. Now, how did I find these three viruses? By looking at the PCR data. But here's something we were talking about just before we went on air. One of the questions I get asked by folks a lot is, why would anybody make a biological weapon that could be used that might harm their own troops? Wouldn't they have a treatment? Good question. And if we follow the PCR data, and I've just started to talk to the people about this, if you follow that PCR data and you listen to what I've talked about Ralph Barrick for the last 2.5 years now, Ralph Barrick didn't start with coronaviruses. He started with a virus known as transmissible. That means back and forth from person to person. Gastroenteritis, that means it caused GI disturbance, virus. Transmissible gastroenteritis virus, acronym TGEF. And when you look at that, what you discover is Ralph Barrick was playing around with drugs with TGEF and early coronavirus work. And in 1985, the first papers got published showing that there is a drug that you cannot get. It's a research drug only. Even though it has outperformed remdesivir, hands down, you cannot get E64D, also known as loxostatin, even though the data shows that E64D / loxostatin prevents coronaviruses from attaching to cells, tremendously reduces its ability to make itself inside of cells, interferes with the inflammation and blood clotting that I told people would happen with viruses back in 1994, that theory that everybody talks about, but nobody seems to have really read or understood. And it reduces damage to the brain from prion diseases caused by these spike proteins and even just head injury. So aloxostatin, E64D, they have known since 1985 does all of these things. And what are we dealing with these coronaviruses? Attachment, inflammation and blood clotting, inflammatory thrombotic response, and prion diseases. The federal government is aware of this because there was a paper published last year comparing it to remdesivir, and this drug blew remdesivir out of the water.
So my question is, does this mirror what we saw early on, and this is really funny, is how politicized this had become. So when COVID-19 originally kind of came up and we were very worried in the States, Donald Trump took a bunch of actions and he got up there and talked about hydroxychloroquine, which became the most demonized drug, even though it's been used, you know, hundreds of thousands of times. It's a very common drug, antiviral properties, right? So was this a political issue? Like, I'm struggling to wonder why these, because I haven't heard of some of these drugs that you cannot find that haven't been, you know, that are not discussed, because remdesivir is the one that everybody, you know, that all these doctors are pointing to unanimously. It seems as if they all agree simultaneously, but then there's a bunch of scientists who are saying, wait a second, what is going on right now? There are perfectly viable treatments that do not have the side effects that remdesivir has, particularly on your kidneys, and your, or is it your liver? I'm not sure which one. It's just bad for you.
Well, the problem is that you can't split out, because the virus and that inflammation and blood clotting, that inflammatory thrombotic response I keep talking about and have been talking about since 1994, will cause the same type of damage that remdesivir might to the organs. You can't tell if it's the virus or the drug is the problem. What we do know, and we just presented this. So we did, our group did a national clinical trial where we actually used the patent that I have to measure the tissue changes with treatment to see what works and what doesn't work. And I just presented, it's been published, but I just presented the research on that at the American Society of Nuclear Cardiology conference. Now, this is the first major medical conference that I'm aware of that has published or had presented at the conference results of drug treatment for this virus, or as you now know, I would say virus does, right? And the unique thing is, when the doctors were presented this objective data, they didn't say, oh, well, hydroxychloroquine can't possibly work. They said, oh, wow, look at that. It works. Because they could see the scientific data that they haven't been allowed to see for 2.5 years. And when you look at the data comparing, let me back up. On remdesivir, we also showed them the remdesivir data. It works as a first-line drug 28% of the time. So if you got it and you got better, you think it's gold, right? I mean, that's how people think. I got better. That's the drug that was used. It's great. Until you realize that if a drug can make you better, stay the same, or make you worse, that's a 33 and a third percent chance. So it underperformed chance. And we measured that, right? We also saw that when it was combined with other drugs, people got worse. So this type of data is critical. And it's the type of data that people have been begging for. And the response, I literally got told, I'm not saying this to pat myself on the back, I literally got told this was the best paper they'd heard presented at the conference. That's how much people are begging for real solid data. And when they get it, guess what? The physicians and the scientists who hear it are waking up. They get it.
Well, I think that's so true. And I think we also, there's so many factors we have to point out right now, because we're going to go to break right now, but I want afterwards, I want to talk about obesity and the vaccine, because I think that this is one of the most overlooked things. When this virus was coming down the pipeline, what did they point us to, right? Masks, social distancing, isolation, which are not healthy for your body, by the way, to stay inside and not go to the gym, shutting down gyms, which are often people's only chance to get in shape. There was no conversation as to health. There was no conversation as to obesity. There was no conversation about vitamins or getting proper nutrition or remaining active or getting sunlight. There was nothing about that. Nothing about keeping your body healthy, keeping your immune system effective. That was not at all something that the health industry wanted to push, because it's hard to profit from people just being healthy by themselves. If you have healthy people, then there's no medicine you need to sell them. They don't need a medicine. They don't need help from you. They're healthy themselves. They can control their own health. That's a nightmare for the health industry. They're not in, they don't have a vested interest in you being healthy. They have a vested interest in you being unhealthy. So you go to them so that they can make you healthy. You know, quotes around make you healthy. Do they actually? I don't think so. This reliance on drugs, this reliance on the pharmaceutical companies, we need to get away from if we're going to start restoring some order here, because there's so much power being placed in the hands of these companies because of people's reliance on them in the first place. That's the most important thing. Be an individual, get yourself, you know, oriented, get your nutrition right, get your health right. Don't be like, make sure you take care of obesity. This is one of the biggest problems. I want to talk to you about this right after a short break.
TNT Radio's Jeremy Nell.
Jeffrey Epstein actually is not all that significant. He's just a cog in the machine.
He's like in a managerial position. I wouldn't put him at the top at all. Yeah, he's sort of like middle management, I guess you could say, for this particular group that I'm writing about. Well, maybe for some people. I don't know. I think it's important to tackle who this group really is and what they've done over the years and what they're continuing to do, because we're currently living through their end game. He was intimately tied to not just the formation, but the trajectories of two of the most influential foundations in the world today, the Clinton Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Maybe the idea that Jeffrey Epstein is middle management is unsettling to people, but it's also, I guess, in a sense, potentially useful, because there's so much public interest in the Epstein case, perhaps for the wrong reasons, because of, you know, the salaciousness of what most people know about it. There's a lot of people in the public that want to know more about Epstein and at a deep level, even if they don't know the details of it, know that there's something very wrong with the way he allegedly died, the alleged client list, and all sorts of things like that. So there's definitely people that want to know more.
Jeremy Nell and Germ Warfare on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Wokeness is infiltrating churches, and people don't really know what's hitting them.
Critical race theory assumes that racism is everywhere. It is in everything. These ideologies have crept into the church.
I have grown up with this invisible kind of bag of privilege.
And I know, as a white pastor, I have blind spots.
Reparations fits into the scope of the gospel.
It's a racist worldview. You're swimming in racism.
The social justice warriors say, if you're white, you are racist. And if you say that you are not a racist, then you have to be a white supremacist.
I see within evangelicalism today an attack on the very gospel itself.
Social justice doesn't have to do with justice, it has to do with Marxism.
Wokeness is now the dominant academic paradigm on many university and college campuses.
Many of our Christian universities have fallen prey.
I went to an all-black school, raised in a black context. Everything was oppression. White people are racist, cops can't be trusted, and this world is not for us, it's against us. We felt like the government owed us. I have a family, I have children, and I don't have a job. I was just, it was at the darkest point in my life.
Because I was white, would we have to divorce and separate due to my skin color?
Christianity enables people to find forgiveness and redemption. However, Marxism is completely vindictive.
There is no redeemer and there is no redemption in the religion of anti-racism.
I believe that the evangelical church today is going to have to make a decision. Are we going to submit to the culture, or are we going to remain true to the faith and take the consequences?
How the left
is stealing your church. The invasion of the gospel of woke.
At salemnow.com.
A cashless society means zero cash. No tipping the waiter or hairdresser. No giving to busking musicians. No selling unwanted items for cash. No buying anything with privacy. Digital currency means every cent you receive will be recorded and every transaction tracked. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Michael Parker Show. This is your host, Owen Stevens. I'm joined by Dr. Richard Fleming. We're talking about COVID-19, the lies behind this virus, the way that they have tried to limit the amount of treatments available to push a one-size-fits-all vaccine, a bioweapon that is endangering the lives of millions of Americans and their children as well. This is absolutely horrible. I want to talk about also in our culture right now, another element behind this disease, really behind all disease, which is obesity. We're living in a time right now, especially where the younger generation is going through something called the body positivity movement, which is normalizing obesity. Obesity is a health issue. It is not a matter of, you know, it's not a matter of social acceptance. That's not what we're talking about. But that's what our culture is going to demand. It's going to demand that we, you know, push obesity as normal and as healthy and as beautiful. What are we viewing right now on all of these magazines? This, you know, we've got traditional Sports Illustrated magazines putting obese models on the cover, trying to glorify and normalize being unhealthy. There's a reason that, and this is a controversial thing, right? It's just crazy to say this nowadays. People look at you like you're crazy to say that putting very fit and attractive and skinny and healthy fit models on the cover of magazines is the best way to go. Why? Because it's harder to be that than it is to be obese and fat and lazy. The reason that those models on the cover look that way, first of all, the reason that they should be there is because it's very difficult to be fit. It's hard to remain that way. Those models are healthy. You know, that they're fit, they're attractive and healthy. That's what we want. That's the ideal. When did we switch? When did the ideal become, you know, be whatever you want, right? It's this whole culture of self-service, serving yourself as your own personal God, you know, treating yourself like your own God, really. Like you can get fat and it doesn't matter. And whatever anybody says to you, if they say that you're unhealthy, they're fat phobic. If they tell you to go run, they're fat phobic. And if you see a skinny model on a magazine, you're supposed to be angry. Like this whole culture is so devastating because little kids are going to take this in. This is damaging to little kids. Instead of teaching them that being healthy is an essential value of American life, we're teaching them that eating whatever they want, sitting on their butt, not being physically active, not caring about their nutrition is just as fine and they're just as beautiful. And it's leading to depression, it's leading to anxiety, and when these diseases come up, it's leading to death. One of the primary risk factors, the comorbidities of COVID-19 was obesity. Is this disease fat phobic? It sure as heck is, because if you have obesity, you are at risk. One of the things, Dr. Fleming, you were on a True Health podcast, and you talked about obesity. You said it's one of the primary reasons why these chemicals exist in the body called cytokines and interleukins, which are chemicals that are, if I'm right, that are released from one type of blood cell to another type of blood cell to signal that there's a problem. And this is all, you know, obesity has this fundamental role in the inflammatory process. What is going on with obesity as it relates to this inflammatory process and these inflammatory diseases and COVID-19 in general?
Outstanding question, because this is actually the area that my work was coming from, was the predisposing factors for heart disease and these other inflammation and blood clotting diseases. And obesity is clearly one of those issues. We know that the fat cells, particularly in the abdomen, are very prone to make these inflammation and blood clotting factors, whether they be cytokines or interleukins or a variety of other chemicals, that basically say there's a problem that needs to be addressed. And the more obesity that there is, the less physical activity you have, which affects not only your weight, but, you know, as you increase your exercise level, a blood marker known, a clotting factor known as fibrinogen goes down. So we know that obesity, diabetes, all these things that are plaguing younger people is the direct result of poor dietary and lifestyle practices. One of the comments that I've made repeatedly, and I did it again in Clearwater, Florida here about a week and a half ago, where we were talking about this at a vitamin C conference. So it's called the VCICI conference. You may want to look at that. It's, I don't belong to it. I'm not promoting it, but I was there presenting and we had a Q&A, and I made the comment. I said, yes, when we locked down, when the countries were locked down, what happened? People became inactive. They ate garbage. They drank more. Some people were smoking more. They got overweight.
Yeah, well,
everything
part of that
to make the disease worse.
Yeah. Well, we have to diagnose why that is, though, which is, I think it's free-floating anxiety. So one of the things about social isolation is that social isolation contributes to a high feeling of free-floating anxiety, which is feeling fear and anxiety without really knowing why. One of the things I think that a lot of people do that I use, at least, to battle anxiety is food. Whenever I'm eating really delicious food, I'm not really that anxious. I feel pretty good. I'm, you know, immediately following eating a burger or fries, I feel terrible. And you escalate the anxiety tenfold after you eat crap. But at least for that, you know, microscopic moment, that piece of pizza, that ice cream, you know what I mean? That fried food, whatever it is, it makes you feel awesome. Food is a drug, everybody, especially, food from this modern American diet that is completely deprived of any nutrients that are going to help you. And it's just stuffed full of meaningless nutrients, bunch of fat, bunch of fried crap. It's not going to help you. It's not going to give you energy, right? But it's going to make you feel satiated, and it's going to, you know, it's going to help your anxiety. No one can be anxious when they're eating ice cream. It's not possible, right? When you're eating ice cream, you're doing great, right? But then immediately following that, you're terrible, right? So this is, I think, what a lot of people use to medicate themselves with this high, you know, feeling of free-floating anxiety that they dealt with as a result of social isolation.
Yeah, you know, one and ice cream is a good classic example. I used to see a lot of people that would come into the practice that they would eat a bowl of ice cream before going to bed. Well, one thing it's that crazy. I would see classically with that is the triglycerides would go up, right? Which are the fats that make saturated fat and cholesterol. So, you know, it's even just moving it earlier in the day was beneficial, but you really do have to watch what you put in your body. You know, it's a little hypocritical for a society to say, you know, it's the drug companies that have me putting garbage into my body. If you're also putting garbage into your body, I mean, you know, well, you can blame other people for only so much, but a vast amount of taking care of the health of your body. And our ancestors knew this, by the way. I mean, our ancestors were a lot more physically active. In the early 1900s, they ate roughly 3,000 calories a day, but they did easily way more physical labor to burn off those calories. And that physical labor meant that they were actually physically activating themselves. And when they sat down and actually ate, they actually ate meals as a family unit and tended to talk and discuss the events of the day. So you dealt with things. So we've had a lot of changes in our culture that a lot of people want to justify because they're so busy and very important. And you know, I make a habit of sitting down with my children at least one meal a day to make sure that we talk about what's going on so that they know, A, that I care, and B, I know what's going on with them, right?
Yeah.
But it also develops those social interaction skills. And, you know, again, quarantining people took away those social interaction skills. You know, I mean, we had people that were stuck to... I mean, well, we all know how to Zoom now, right? So that's wonderful. We've learned a new technical skill that means that we don't really need to interact with people anymore. But all of these behaviors did an awful lot to cause physical health to deteriorate. And you're seeing it as the numbers come out with the shortening lifespan in the United States over the last couple of years. This is the first time in many decades that we've seen the lifespan of a typical American go down. Now, it may not feel like much to you, but, you know, it says something when we have the ability to do so much, and yet the consequence of everything we're doing is now showing a shorter lifespan. Obesity,
it's
just another one of those inflammatory thrombotic diseases. Oh, yes,
it's
definitely the quality of food. Yeah, you know, people seem to think that if they eat a lot and it makes them full, that that's good. Garbage in, garbage out. you know?
Yeah. Well, also, even the foods that aren't supposed to be garbage. Yeah, like, well, vegetables. The other problem is that if you go to the store thinking that the vegetables that you are buying are going to make you healthier because you're eating vegetables, that's not necessarily true. Like, with everything, there's so much that's being injected inside of those veggies, so many chemicals that are used in the, you know, in the processing of those vegetables and fruits. It's like when you go to the supermarket and you go to get a strawberry, you want a freshly picked strawberry that hasn't been tampered with. You're not going to find that. The only strawberry that you can get is a roided out strawberry. They injected it with like testosterone, and it's just going to be this bloated muscular berry that when you drink inside, when you bite inside of it, it's just water. This roided out berry that's going to provide you nut doesn't even taste like a strawberry. We got to go to news. I'll be right back with Dr. Richard Fleming after a short news break.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines.
Tesla has announced that it's recalling some 1.1 million cars in the U.S., citing a safety issue with the automatic window reversal system. British Prime Minister Liz Truss told the UN General Assembly that free nations should band together and act as an economic NATO to defend prosperity against the malevolent influence of authoritarian regimes like Russia and China. Donald Trump could be allowed back on Facebook in time for the 2024 election season.
Do you have a suggestion for a possible guest or host that you'd like to hear on TNT Radio?
Or perhaps you have a topic you feel we should discuss?
Then we want to hear from you. Simply complete the suggestion form on the TNT Radio website. Help us make a difference on TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Michael Parker Show. This is your host, Owen Stevens. I'm joined today by Dr. Richard Fleming. We're talking about the American diet. And even if you think you are eating healthy, you might not be. Right? Choosing the produce and the fruits that you eat is incredibly important. So choose local. One of the advices I can give you is, you know, be as locally centered as possible. And do I dare say, do it yourself? Man, like grow vegetables yourself, grow fruits yourself, be self-sustained, be able to, you know, homestead, get some chickens, get some vegetables in there, get some fruits in there. It's so much fun. It'll give your kids a nice, relaxing, and very enjoyable thing to do outside, apart from their video games. But Dr. Fleming, what do you think about this American diet and, you know, how even some of our typical healthy foods have become injected with chemicals and now lack the essential nutrients that we wish and hope that they had?
Well, as a Viking, bloodline Viking, you know, one of the things that people don't know about us is that we also tend to be farmers. And so Vikings tend to be farmers as well as, you know, conquerors. And they tend to, we tended to dominate in textiles and food. So my family was raised in Iowa. We were a farm family, so we know what real farm food tastes like. And I had this conversation with somebody just a couple of days ago that I never noticed anybody going into a grocery store and smelling the food, the fresh produce, which is something I do because I'm looking for the smell and the texture and the feel of the actual food, because it tells you what's going into your body. You're spot on when you talk about buying local, because when foods are shipped from all over the country, they're already treated with chemicals that you've already talked about, but they're already picked prematurely with the idea that they're somehow going to mature at once they've been plucked, which means they're now dead. And
so dumb.
And it's simply not going to happen. You know, my children, when they were growing up, I used to know that they were home because I would hear the garage door go up. And that was it. And what that meant was I could look out back and see them in the strawberries and the berry bushes in the area where we were growing food, which is kind of hard to get upset with your children about not getting inside right away and doing their studies when you know they're outside actually taking something out of your crops. And you can't imitate this taste. You know, the flavor, I mean, I'll just give a bad example. Bad example is Red Delicious apples. When I was a kid growing up, I think they really legitimately were somewhat delicious. Now, I have to tell you, they have no taste. Many of the foods have no taste. And that, even if everything else was there, it's the flavor of the food that you're going for that should be the reason why you're doing it. It's healthy, it's good for you, and it tastes good. Well, it's lost its flavor. Yeah.
Yeah, there's
no
taste.
I mean, I don't know why we want to do that, right? Because Yeah, because
it's like we've chosen huge size over taste. And the straw, like I said, the strawberries are, it's crazy. I mean, think about how big a blackberry is. So one of the things that we did is we grew blackberries in our backyard. And blackberries are not big. They don't grow very big. They're pretty small. You're lucky to get one that's like, when you find a blackberry that's actually like whole and it's like, you know, the size of your pinky nail, maybe, that's a good find. That's a good blackberry. It's delicious. It's juicy. It's sour. Yeah. It's rich. But now you go to the store and they're the size of my palm. They're huge. It's crazy what's going on right now.
They don't taste and they have no flavor.
They have no flavor.
I mean, it's gross. I gave a presentation in Sapporo, Japan, maybe about 15 years ago, and they measured everything. If it wasn't the exact same size, they threw it out. And the problem was is that they were driving their food costs up. Well, thinking that everything has to be the exact same size in a food product is kind of silly. Again, it's the quality of the food. The smell will tell you whether it's any good for you. And then the nutritional value of that is keen. You know, I have some folks that my mother, when she was a girl, you know, and I had to do this as a kid, you know, we went out and we dealt with the chickens, the baby chicks, right? If you think farm living is comfortable and easy, folks, look, it's not, but it's a great life. And you don't have to become farmers. I'm not telling you to go become farmers, but it doesn't hurt to get your hands dirty a little bit and realize that you just actually grew something and then you can enjoy the taste of it. I mean, tomatoes or tomatoes, however you want to pronounce it, is another example. Sweet corn. I will tell you, growing up in Iowa, I know what sweet corn tastes like. I haven't had sweet corn in more than a decade because if you don't grow it in your garden, it is garbage. There's no flavor to it. It doesn't even look like sweet corn, but it's been modified. We have lots of it. So, I mean, we're eating now a lot of garbage. And I don't know, I guess because people are so used to processed foods, they don't mind the fact that something really doesn't have a real taste to it. But I used to take people and explain to them on their heart disease, go in and buy fruits and vegetables, and they would literally go, so you want me to buy apples, bananas, and I don't know, they would come up with something else like corn, which by the way, isn't a vegetable, it's a grain. And I would say, yeah, you know, those first couple rows that you all ignore, that's actually real food, you know, that you can go pick and size and then cut up. And you know, it's astonishing how many different foods are available. I just think that we've gotten to this place where we think that more is better as opposed to buying what's in season, where you're at, and getting the benefit of that. You know, that's one of the benefits of traveling to places is, well, what do you grow here? Let me taste what you grow that I can't get somewhere else, you know?
Yeah, that's such a cool thing about traveling.
Yeah, I mean, and all you need to do is ask the natives, where do you go eat? You know, where do you go eat?
I want to bring it back to
some of the best food I've had are in dumps. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to bring it back to the vaccine now, because I think that, yes, this problem with obesity is a serious issue, right? And I think we've always known that. We've always known that obesity was a prerequisite to disease. Like, it's going to really impact your susceptibility to a lot of this stuff. And I think that that's something that I think a lot of people can agree with. I mean, doctors will even tell you that. But one thing we do not agree on is this vaccine. I went into an urgent care visit. I give this story a lot. I went into this urgent care visit and I had a problem with my ankle and I needed it checked out. I wanted to see if it was sprained or something. Go in there and this doctor comes in. He's got double masks, a face shield, two gloves, and a little vial of hand sanitizer. He was dressed like he was combating like a zombie apocalypse spread. It was insane. And I'm sitting here, no mask, nothing. I'm not wearing a mask. I refused to. And, you know, he comes in and he goes, okay, you don't have a mask on. I was like, yeah, I don't have one on. I'm not going to wear one, obviously. Like, you cannot make me wear this mask. Do your job. And I'm very standoffish. And maybe that was bad on my part to be so standoffish. But he started lecturing me and he asked, did you receive the COVID-19 shot, the vaccine? You really need to have that. And I said, nope. And I shouldn't have answered yes or no because that's my personal information. It shouldn't, it's not his business. But this guy completely violated Nuremberg codes that are set in place. You cannot offer up an experimental vaccine to a person who is unwilling. And he demanded that I get the shot. And I said, absolutely not. Treat me for what I'm here for, and, or leave me alone and I'll get another doctor. So this, and I had to get in an argument with a doctor about this vaccine, right? And then you have some people that know exactly what this is. One of the things that you testified was that the mRNA-RNA vaccines produced by Pfizer, Moderna, and Janssen are bioweapons delivering the same toxic spike protein as the virus, but in loads up to 5 million times higher. The vaccinated are responsible for pressure-selecting variants, Alpha, Delta, Omicron, etc., and prolonging the epidemic. The vaccine also disrupts the natural immune system, making the vaccinated more susceptible to infection and disease. And the vaccine damages red blood cells and causes hyperinflammatory and clotting that cause disease and death in its own right. And we're calling this a vaccine, even though I'd really just think it to be a technology. What are your opinions on this vaccine? Like, I've just mentioned some of the things you've testified to, but what troubles you most about this vaccine, especially as it relates to heart health?
Well, to begin with, I was just listening to you and thinking, I think you've been listening to what I've been saying. and none of it's opinion. It's all published research. It's data. It's fact. What bothers me most about the vaccine is the fact that they're now going to a new version of it with the premise that they're going to be doing this now every year in perpetuity for people that are willing to allow themselves to be vaccinated. And I've told people, if I'm not anti-vax, I'm anti-stupid. although it's kind of hard to say right now. I'm thinking about some of the others as people try to justify a lot of things. You know, we know that what these vaccines do is that they reverse transcribe, just like HIV does, to get into our DNA. And the long-term effect of that, we don't know. We know that it lasts longer in the bloodstream and the body than people thought. The premise that this was ever a good idea, when nothing has ever materialized for any other disease using this mRNA technology, is if it wasn't for the fact that it's devastated so many people, would be laughable, because the science is just not there to support it. The science in the emergency use authorization document showed that there wasn't a clinical benefit for people, either reducing the number of patients who get sick enough to be called COVID patients or die. So we've seen this for more than a year and a half. We've seen the increase in excess deaths associated with most of the vaccines, and we've seen no significant impact on the transmission of this of these viruses, which I think should have been obvious, because no vaccine prevents people from getting infected. In fact, you must get infected for a vaccine to have any potential benefit, and it doesn't prevent you from transmitting. So the information that was spread around about this is just amazing. This is where the academic physician type like myself wants to say, okay, clearly none of you students paid attention in class. It's time you all come back to class. We need to we need to reorient you here, because you are so far out of bounds here on demonstrating that you should be allowed to pass this class and treat patients that it's really, really sad. You know, we're going after these people. It is very clear that this virus, these viruses and the vaccines, are biological weapons, and these are criminal actions. They violate the Biological Weapons Convention Treaty. They violate the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. They violate the Declaration of Helsinki. They violate the Nuremberg Codes, and they violate for physicians the AMA Code of Ethics. So this is criminal action. This is not civil. Everybody playing around with civil suits are spending a lot of time, I think, to get attention, and perhaps just so they can say they're doing something. But civil suits will not turn this back. The only way to address this is with criminal actions, and that requires not just comfortable attorneys doing it, but this requires prosecuting attorneys, attorney generals, and district attorneys. And so for that reason, we have started the number 10 letters, LETTERS.org campaign. where people can go on, fill out their mailing information. It will generate a letter to both their attorney general and their governor that can then be downloaded and sent in. For many of them, there's an email if you want to do it that way. There's also an indictment letter signed by myself, Kevin McCarron, Charles Rixey, John Dinert, and Andrew Huff, all going after these people with real criminal charges. The crimes against humanity tour that we're doing, of which we're going to be in New Jersey here next week, and Philadelphia, is designed to help people understand this information, to get them motivated. Because if you think that this pandemic is over, then you are as confused as President Biden. And I guess I'm here as the White House staff now to point out that maybe that's a misstatement, because this is perpetuating itself. There are at least three viruses that came out, more than 28 variants. This stuff is changing genetic code. They've chased it with the vaccines. They're coming up with new vaccines, and there will be new vaccines after this, and more viruses and more manipulation and more control to see what it takes to get Americans and people around the world to acquiesce, to surrender, to be engulfed by the control of other people. And the only way to stop this is with criminal indictments. And 10letters.org gets the average American citizen to have a voice in what's going on, because nothing else is going to give you a voice. You are shouting in the dark otherwise. But if you send that in, it's going to go to one of two types of attorney general. Either attorney generals in the states that want to take these people down and want to be able to say, my people in my state are supporting me, or they are attorney generals that want to allow this to move forward, possibly for a variety of reasons that doesn't matter, but they need to be inundated also by their constituents stating, we want a grand jury to be convened. And in the states of North Dakota and Nebraska and New Mexico and Nevada and Oklahoma and Kansas, there's an additional thing that we're doing that in those six states, in addition to just telling the attorney general to do it, there are actually ways in those states to force the attorney generals to indict these people. So what we want are these attorney generals to take the evidence that I've provided and other people have provided in these crimes against humanity tour, but I have laid it out in, you know, in the book, Is COVID-19 a Bioweapon, a Scientific Forensic Investigation, in the deposition I've given, in the affidavit that's on FlemingMethod.com. All that data is there. It's compelling. It's clear. It says who paid the money, what patents, and there's only two, the Fuhrer and Cleavage site and the chimeric gain-of-function research on the spike protein, and the published papers that show whose hands are dirty, bloodied, and what they were trying to get away with to hold them criminally accountable in federal court and state court.
So who are the officials that we would be, you know, directing these criminal investigations into? Is it organizations? Is it individuals? I imagine Anthony Fauci would be the target of numerous lawsuits, you know, criminally. I mean, we know we've got guys like Rand Paul questioning his involvement with these gain of function practices, this gain of function research, and then openly lying and committing perjury in court when discussing this. So who are we going to direct these, you know, these criminal allegations towards?
Right. So there's several different people. The CDC director is one. Anthony Fauci is another one. Collins is another one. Bill Gates is another one. I mean, we have eight or nine.
The CDC director is Rochelle Walensky. Rochelle Walensky, yeah. Am I correct in that?
Right,
yes. Okay.
Right. And it's very specifically stated on this letter for indictment that's available on 10letters.org. And above and beyond the criminal actions I talked about for the violations of the treaty, to make it clear for the state attorney generals, the crimes that these people have committed by this gain of function, these viruses and these vaccines are murder, attempted murder,
yes,
manslaughter, reckless manslaughter, assault, battery, coercion, false imprisonment, and for some folks, need I say Anthony Fauci's name in big letters, perjury.
Yes.
And by the
and then
way,
there's also the if you there's also guys like the governor of New York, Cuomo, who I think should be prosecuted, you know, for the murder of thousands of old people who he knew were going to die and discarded their lives like trash. So, you know, I think that this is far reaching. I think you could also implement, you know, the lies that have been told by the Biden administration, some of their, you know, some of their officials.
Right.
You've got people like Rachel Levine out there spewing misinformation. Keep going.
But we want to be very focused and very targeted. We know the people that we can prove this on. And the beauty, now I'm speaking as an attorney because, you know, I'm a PhD, MD, JD, so now my JD attorney hat goes on, where once we start deposing, like I tell people, I can solve problems, treat them, and cause them. When we start deposing them and collecting the evidence, anybody else that gets pulled out as being part of this, they're now part of it. But we know we can get these people nailed from the evidence that I'm already providing these attorney generals. We've done the work. All they have to do is go, ladies and gentlemen, a grand jury. And by the way, a grand jury is not something you do on social media. It's not interviewing somebody and then saying, this is a grand jury. No, it is not. And it mocks the grand jury system, and it weakens our ability to do this. A grand jury is a group of people in states, in cities, AGs and DAs, where they have the responsibility of this prosecutor saying, here's the evidence. Based on the law, we think they have committed crimes. Will you, members of this grand jury, give me an indictment to file on these people, to hold them criminally accountable, take them to criminal court before our state courts and hold these people criminally accountable so that we can put them in prison or in some instances, maybe something better.
Yes, that's what we need and want, but it's not happening. What are the obstacles that are standing in our way?
The only obstacle literally standing in our way right now is the lack of Americans going onto 10letters.org and filing. Because if we inundate these attorney generals and district attorneys and governors with these letters, they will have to file for these indictments.
Okay.
If people do not stand up and take this action, these people go free.
Well, that's good news then. That's good news, because I think that one of the things that stops people from acting is despair. If you think that there's a word called, I think it's efficacy. Efficacy is an important thing to inspire within people, which is the ability of feeling like you have control or can manipulate the outcome of a situation. Mm-hmm. You can better the outcome of a situation. You can make a difference. That's the feeling. Efficacy, feeling like you can make a difference. People don't feel that way. Go ahead.
I have not spent 2.5 years working on this virus and figuring out who did what and to develop a plan that wouldn't work. This plan, this works. This uses the laws of the state and the powers of the people. We the people, remember that? We the people, that's supposed to be what's running this country. Well, we the people.
Amen.
And my youngest son came up with this. He said, if we inundate, so one of the videos out there is that Harry Potter video where, you know, the mail keeps coming in, inviting Harry to go to Hogwarts, and it overwhelms the people inside. That's the goal. We will overwhelm these attorney generals, and they will know that the American people have said, want indictments. If these people are innocent, they should want their day in court. They should be willing to say, we will stand up against this. But Americans can stand up. We, 10letters.org gives them the power to do this. That's it. If they do it.
Well, that's so encouraging.
If the people would do it, we've got them. Because we've done the rest of the work behind the scenes to get the evidence. And it's more than just EcoHealth. It's all of them. So I've got an umbrella case of which Kevin McCarron, Charles Rixey, Joanna Deinert, and Andrew Huff provide corroborative evidence that nobody can miss. these people are guilty of sin. I know that's an old expression. Sorry, 66 kids. Guilty of sin, and it's time to take them to task. And the American people have an obligation to the country, to their children, to their grandchildren, and to the rest of the world to file 10letters.org to get these indictments and take these people down. The rest of the world, this is our country. As a scientist physician, this happened on my watch. I'm not going to let it go because of that. I can't do it by myself, but the American people are much more powerful if they will send these letters in than they could possibly imagine. It will be impossible not to get these indictments. And we've been talking with attorney generals. We've been talking with regional district attorneys. We know they want to file it. Many of them want to file it. They need the support of the people.
We got to go. That was Dr. Fleming, everybody. We'll be back after the break.